60 back and forth in this delicate balance. And so whenever we have a situation like this where we have near cancellation of fluxes, then we can be concerned about what might happen if that balance was disturbed. If we just look at the record of carbon dioxide in Mauna Loa, then we see the huge seasonal cycle in the carbon dioxide concentration, which dwarfs the gain in the carbon dioxide due to human input on for any given year. If we go back further in time, this very recent result from an ice core in Antarctica going back now 800,000 years shows that there is a very strong correlation between the carbon dioxide concentration and the temperature as extracted from isotopes, stable isotopes in the ice core. Even small features like this show up here. It's an amazing correlation continuing to back in time. So as I mentioned, we had this conference in early May. And a large focus of that conference was on the links between ecosystems and climate. I have to say that I noticed a real coming together between the sort of traditional climate physicists, atmospheric scientists, and ecosystem people at this conference, a real good discussion between these different groups. So John Hart, who was originally trained as a theoretical physicist and now is an ecologist who does both experimental field work and theoretical work, led off our conference talking about the physics of feedbacks. We have some input going into a system, yielding an output. If we return some of that and in a gain type picture here, then for our input, we get an output plus the gain times the input plus the gain times the gain, because we keep on amplifying. We can sum up that series, and our output is equal to the input divided by 1 minus the gain. And the gain, if we're thinking about temperature as our output, we might be concerned with the variation in the temperature of, say, carbon dioxide concentration times the variation of the carbon dioxide concentration with temperature. If the Earth warms, perhaps more carbon dioxide will be released into the atmosphere, further warming the Earth. And so by quantifying this gain, we get some idea for how large this feedback, potential feedback is. So Hart and others have argued that we could perhaps use that ice core data that we just saw to try to calculate this gain. So there's certainly a apparent correlation between the carbon dioxide concentration and the temperature here as revealed by deuterium as the temperature proxy. So if we assume a linear relationship governed by this data, this is telling us perhaps that as the Earth warms, more carbon dioxide is released, although that's really the causal direction of that hypothesis is something that really needs to be clarified further. So Hart notes that a number of feedbacks have already been included in the models prior to the latest generation, which is now attempting to include some of this carbon feedback. So water vapor, sorry, this isn't very visible, contributes a gain of about 0.40. When the Earth warms, there's more water vapor. Water vapor, as we saw, is a very strong greenhouse gas. So this is uncondensed water vapor, not clouds. Ice and snow, when the Earth warms, we might expect ice and snow to melt back, and so the Earth will absorb more visible light, leading to further warming. And clouds, which, as I mentioned, have the greatest uncertainty, have both a potential cooling effect, a negative feedback, or a warming effect, a positive feedback, depending on the type of cloud and their distribution. So the total of all these gains is something like 0.7, but with a very large range of uncertainty. If we insert that into our formula for the temperature due to a doubling of carbon dioxide, which would be by itself only a 1 degree warming due to doubling, we now have to amplify that by 1 divided by 1 minus 0.7. So that brings us to about 3.5 degrees Celsius, which is the type of figure that's typically shown on these projections from, in this case, the IPCC. here's 3.5 degrees. Doubling of carbon dioxide will be somewhere around the middle of this century. But the huge range of uncertainty there, reflecting the uncertainty in these feedback processes primarily. So Hart emphasized that besides the uncertainty, there's also a large asymmetry in this response due to the fact that the response is 1 over 1 minus g. So if we have a positive increase in the feedback, that leads to a much larger change than a decrease in g. So let's go back and assume that the ice core data reflects a feedback process. Here's our 1 degree Celsius warming for a doubling of CO2, so an increase from 275 to 550 parts per million by volume, that coming from the models. So that's dt dCO2, this partial derivative. And then we multiply by this partial derivative that tells us how much the carbon dioxide will increase if the temperature increases, assuming that the ice core data actually reflects that. So just reading off the slope of this line, about 15 parts per million per degree Celsius, that contributes something like 5%. But which looks rather small, but it's a positive feedback, and since we're already close to 1 minus 0.7, that actually goes to 1 minus 0.76, and so we increase from 3.4 to 4.2 degrees. We would expect the linear assumption will break down, certainly. So all of this is predicated on a linear response idea, but we know that, of course, this is going to diverge if we approach 1. And so generally, we would expect some limiting processes. So I think all this calculation really tells us is it just gives us some feeling for the importance, relative importance of these processes without being too quantitative. Right, so Inez Fung followed John's talk by giving us some more detailed pictures of the carbon cycle, focusing primarily on terrestrial plants, noting again these large fluxes of carbon on a yearly basis between soils and plants in the atmosphere. She pointed out that plants have other effects. For example, during the growing season, transpiration, water vapor, latent heat release tends to reduce the diurnal night-day temperature difference. So there's a spring chill when the growing season starts. This is the night-day temperature difference during the course of the year, and you can see that it dips here. So this tends to have a moderating influence on the actual climate. So clear indication that our ecosystems are directly affecting a climate cannot be ignored. She also noticed that the amplitude of the seasonal cycle in the carbon dioxide concentration, which had been growing in recent years, has now leveled off and started to go down. And that can perhaps be attributed to droughts reducing photosynthesis and therefore reducing the amplitude of the seasonal cycle. So how would carbon dioxide and climate co-vary? So by the way, all of these slides are from her talk, which I've taken off of the website. And you can, too, if you want to look at her slides and also listen to her talk. So atmospheric carbon dioxide would increase because warming might enhance decomposition. Increased ocean stratification through the warm upper layer would reduce the amount of mixing of carbon dioxide back into the sea. But it could also decrease because warming might enhance photosynthesis and it might enhance marine productivity. So there's, as usual, the great complexity of the ecosystems are reflected in the different possibilities here. So I just want to pick from one other talk, actually. This is from Matt Huber, who I think is sitting back there. Oh, there he is. He's gave a talk later in our program. We usually have a couple talks each week. And Matt has been interested in reconstructing what's happened in the Eocene about 50 million years ago and argued that this was a period of extreme warmth up in the polar regions, something like 20 degrees Celsius with alligators, palm trees, and And Matt wants to understand how that could possibly have occurred. How could we have such extreme warmth? So one of the things that he did is to run climate models with greatly increased amounts of carbon dioxide. Here, four times our current levels, showing in comparison to the current, four doublings, yes, compared to our current, right, four doublings, so 16 times, right, the current climate, showing that we're getting, of course, very warm in the equatorial regions, but still not quite to the 20 degrees Celsius level up in the polar regions. However, as Matt pointed out, there's these regions here where we're getting to 45 degrees Celsius where plants can't be expected to survive. So I think there's a possible connection with your conference here in this paleoclimate. So for five doublings, so 32 times current concentrations, then we can get two temperatures that are needed up in the high latitudes. Here, this is the five doublings at 90 degrees at the North Pole, South Pole, getting up to this 20 degree mark here that the paleoclimate data seems to suggest we need. But then up here, the plants are dying. So this widespread fire or something might have happened. But I guess apparently the fossil record shows a dearth of fossils during this intensely warm period. So you can talk to Matt, who'll be here for the rest of the week, about that. Finally, physicists have been involved with modeling of fires and ecosystems for a long time. I'm not so familiar with this work, but this is something that Gene, I know, thinks about a lot. This is actually a paper from someone we were hoping would join us but couldn't due to some family health issues, Janice Cohen. Data simulation for wildland fires. So I think that you'll find a receptive audience of physicists who are trained in thinking about simplified models that capture the basic essence of complex phenomena like the spread of a forest fire. Well, we have our own local forest fire. A year ago, the second largest fire in California history, the Zaca fire, was burning just in the mountains over here. It's over 200,000 acres. This is a picture of the fire front. There's a map. There's Santa Barbara. We're located right here. This is the fire zone. It basically burned out almost all of the San Rafael Wilderness area. And we have the possibility for the program participants of going on a field trip on Saturday. The organizers, we're still trying to work out some of the details here. I've been into this region now in two different locations, about here and about here. And it's pretty dramatic, especially in this direction where we're hoping we might be able to gain access through the Forest Service to some back roads. It was a very intense fire, I think, due to the buildup of vegetation. I'm sure many of you know a lot more about this than me. But there's already some of the grasses and flowers are coming back, although a lot of the trees were killed. And so this is a view. I didn't take these pictures, but these are from the Forest Service site, but I was looking on this at this trail, the Santa Cruz Trail, showing how devastating this fire was. So it might be very interesting for us to go back there on Saturday if we could venture in one way or another. It doesn't look quite as bad as this right now. This was taken, I think, before sometime in the winter time, that now there's at least some small plants. So again, welcome to the KIDP. I think you'll find this is a wonderful space to work in. Especially encourage you to work your way up to the porthole room if you haven't been up there. It's up near office 2512. There's some delightful places to hang out, and you can look at the ocean at the same time. Thanks.